Good afternoon, everyone. I would like to call to order this meeting of the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Glad to have everyone with us this afternoon. The first order of business will be to call the roll. Ms. Niedernhofer.
Liebling.
Present.
Hewitt.
Present.
Schumacher.
Schumacher, present.
Eklund.
Present.
Backer.
Backer, present.
Bonner.
Present.
Bierman. Bierman. Bolden.
Present.
Damuth.
Damuth, present.
Freiberg.
Present.
Grunhagen.
Present.
Keel. Keel. Morrison. Munson.
Munson, present.
Pryor.
Present.
Quam.
Present.
Ryer.
Present.
Schultz.
Present.
Wolgamott.
Wolgamott, present.
A quorum is present.
All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Niedernhofer. And just so the public understands, during this busy time of the year, sometimes members are in other committees presenting bills. And of course, we know sometimes members have difficulty getting tuned in here. Now I see Representative Bierman has managed to join us. So that's great. And I think there was another member. When that member joins, they'll get checked in as well. Thank you. Okay. So we don't have minutes today. We'll catch up with those later on. But today what we're doing is hearing some elements of the governor's budget. We don't have the updated budget numbers yet, but we do have some issues that are going to be in the budget that it's important for us to hear about. And so we're going to get started on that process today. So we appreciate that we have Assistant Commissioner Matt Anderson with us today from the Healthcare Administration at DHS to get us started and talk about several of the issues we're going to cover today. So I think probably the best thing to do would be what we've done in the past, kind of let Assistant Commissioner Anderson get through his presentation on a topic, unless there are questions that really need answering immediately. But let him get through that, and then we'll have time for questions. Also, just so members are aware, Mr. McQuillan did send out the materials for today. He sent out the change pages for some of these items. And of course, earlier on, you all got the entire packet of change pages. I know you've been reading through that every single night to get you to fall asleep, but no, seriously, there is a lot there. But just know that you do have it available to you. And often those change pages are really helpful background on what's been going on in a program, and really do encourage you to read them. And especially if you have particular interest in some of these topics. And with that, we'll go to Assistant Commissioner Anderson. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee. I have, for the record, my name is Matt Anderson, Assistant Commissioner for Healthcare at the Minnesota Department of Human Services. We have, for your discussion today, three of the financial items in the governor's budget, and four non-budget items, or at least non-spending items, or that don't affect the forecast. And so I will try to go through these fairly briefly, but welcome questions. And I'm fortunate to be able to have colleagues from the Department of Human Services who are subject matter experts and may be able to be better positioned than I am to be able to answer some of the detailed questions that I expect you may have. So the first topic is a proposal to redesign our outreach for child and teen checkups. This proposal redesigns the outreach activities to children and their families that are part of our child and teen checkup program, or CNTC. This is Minnesota's version of early periodic screening, diagnosis, and treatment program, sometimes referred to as EPSTD. This program is aimed at identifying and addressing early issues that may impact a child's overall health and development. So many of us are familiar with what we sometimes call well child visits or well child checks. And this is for our Minnesota Care and Medicaid enrollees, a way of making sure that early in a child's development, that we are, that our healthcare system is identifying issues, being able to have early intervention if there is a need for intervention, to be able to improve the child's quality of life and health, but also to be able to address things earlier and therefore more efficiently and more effectively if there are health issues. So a critical component of the child and teen checkup program is outreach to the child or predominantly to their family to notify them when they need a well child visit, when it's coming up, and to be able to provide resources to support them to getting to those appointments, especially if they need an interpreter or transportation services or anything like that. Our participation for our enrollees in child and teen checkup appointments has remained fairly steady, but it's steady below the national average. So the national average is about 60% of Medicaid enrollees, children are getting in for their well child visits. Minnesota's has been at 51 or 53% in the most recent 2 years of data that we have. And so we're looking for ways to improve that, to make sure that more of our children are getting in to be seen and getting those well child visits that we know are so important. Currently, the outreach work is being done by counties and our tribal nation partners. This proposal would shift that responsibility to some of the integrated health partnerships, or IHPs. These are provider organizations that have entered into contracts with the department to provide care for a population of their patients with certain quality metrics that they have to meet and with certain spending targets. And if they are able to meet those, they have a financial incentive that they get to share in the savings that the state achieves. This proposal would say that basically for the roughly 50% of our children that are served by IHPs, we would be asking those IHPs to be the primary contact for outreach to the children and families. This would help align the incentives for those providers by having them responsible for the health outcomes of their patients, to also have the responsibility for doing the outreach to make sure that those patients are getting in for their appointments. To support the IHPs in this new work, they would receive an enhancement to their existing data, so they get more information about their enrollees to be able to help them make sure that they're getting those appointments made, as well as an enhancement to their population-based payment of $12 per year per child. They would be obviously then held to accountability metrics to be able to, that they would need to meet in order to be eligible for those shared savings. The additional cost, that additional $12 per child per year cost, would be offset by reducing the contracts that states have with counties and tribal nations. Currently, we are paying under those contracts $26.50 per child per year. And so this would have a net savings, but it would also increase or improve the care that our child and family populations are receiving, as they would be getting contacted by the provider that they've chosen to work with. And that provider would be able to help them not only understand that they need to get in for a well child visit, but also be able to help them make the appointment and do everything in that same call. And so the proposal is one of those proposals that we're especially excited about, because it reduces the general fund expenditures by $2.4 million in the next biennium and $3.2 million in the following biennium. But by doing that, it's also, we believe, will be improving the care that our enrollees receive, and also increasing that rate of well child visits so that we can get up to or past the national average, where we believe Minnesota should be when it comes to care for our children, and particularly low-income children. The next proposal is compliance with the interoperability and patient access regulations. It's kind of a mouthful, but this is regulations, federal regulations.
And Assistant Commissioner,
yes.
Since we've kind of moved out of one topic, maybe we could pause here. And
that's
if you could stop sharing the screen or whoever's sharing the screen for a moment, and then see if that we have any questions on the first topic that you've addressed here, because, you know, before we skip. And we do. Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. I have just two quick questions. One is, what is the nature of the enhanced data and reports that they would be receiving? Is it something that really would help them be more effective and they would benefit by receiving it anyway? Or is it something that really does fits a different niche of activity?
Mr. Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Ryer. The data would be mostly the same type of data that we share with counties and tribes to be able to do the outreach activities. So they would be getting information that would certainly be helpful for the rest of their care coordination activities and patient population service that they provide. But it would be specifically the most direct utility of it would be for them to be able to understand which of their patient population has been receiving a well child visit and when it's coming due. Obviously, some people, even though they're getting their care from one organization, for one reason or another, they may get a well child visit from a different provider. And so for the IHPs, they would want to be able to know that so they aren't calling patients and saying you need a well child visit and having the patient say, we just had one 6 weeks ago or whatever, to be able to do that in a more effective way.
Okay, I see.
All right, other questions for members? Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Commissioner Anderson. The IHPs, are they statewide or what's the percentage of children that are covered in this model?
Mr. Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative, about 50% of the children in Medicaid and Minnesota Care are covered or are receiving services from an integrated healthcare partnership. So it would not reach all of the our patient population, but it would get to half of the children. The statewide reach is integrated healthcare partnerships are a voluntary model for providers. We have a great cross-section of rural and urban across the state, but I certainly couldn't say that every part of the state is covered. We do have about 50% of the kids in MA, and we do have kids in every county that are receiving care from an integrated healthcare partnership. But obviously there are some areas where it's just by geographic distance or what have you, it's less available or less accessible.
Representative Bierman.
Madam Chair, just one last other question. So when you were talking about the reduction in costs for the department, I think you said $26 is taken away, but 12 is added per child. So that's just based on the county numbers then, is that correct?
Mr. Anderson.
Yes. So the counties would still be receiving payment for the half of the children. Counties or tribes would continue to receive their payment of $26.50 for the children that they continue to be responsible for doing the outreach. The savings is generated from the not paying the counties and the tribal nations the $26.50 for the children that will be assigned and accountable to the integrated healthcare partnerships. And as you mentioned, they would be receiving $12. So there's a $14.50 differential there.
And lastly, Madam Chair, just a question, Mr. Anderson, you mentioned the national average of where we were, and perhaps I missed it. Could you repeat it if you said where we rate?
Mr. Anderson.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative, the national average is that 60% of Medicaid enrolled children receive their well child visits. Minnesota in 2018 was at 51% and in 2019 was 53%. We don't have the data for 2020 yet, but we'd be happy to update you with that when we have it available.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Representative Bierman. I have some questions as well, Mr. Anderson. So first of all, are these children enrolled in managed care, or is this fee-for-service, or is this across both?
Madam Chair, this is across both, although the vast majority of children enrolled in our programs are in managed care.
Okay, so that being the case, I know that under managed care, we have quality measures. And I know we've talked about this a bit in this committee, and maybe at some point when we have time, we'll have someone in, maybe you or another member of your staff, to talk about those quality measures, what they are, how they're applied, and so on with the MCOs. But, you know, managed care organizations, we assume that they're managing care. And yet what we're talking about here is having somebody else manage the care. And we're learning that with regard to these checkups right now, that counties and tribes are managing the care, not the so-called managed care organizations. So I guess my question to you then is there a quality measure on this? If we're only doing 51 or 53% of the kids are getting what they're supposed to get, which frankly, I am kind of stunned at that, honestly. And I know you are too, which is why you're trying to do something about it. But, you know, what about those withholds? I mean, isn't there a quality measure on this? And are we withholding some of the payment as a way of enforcing quality with the MCOs? I mean, what's with that if we're paying other people to make sure this happens and the MCOs are getting our capitated rates?
Madam Chair, it's a good question. The distinction, I think, for DHS is that this is outreach to the children and families. It's not considered care management itself. And so these are payments that are outside of the managed care contracts. These are services that are outside of the managed care contracts. So managed care organizations are not as part of their capitation payment and as part of their accountability factors are not, this is not an activity that we are holding them accountable to. The again, one of the advantages that we think in this approach is beginning to create a stronger connection between that outreach and the provider who's actually delivering the service and bringing those together on a closer basis. And so one of the reasons why, again, that we're, as you mentioned, that we're concerned about the rate of well child visits that have, you know, that Minnesota kids are getting. We wanna improve that rate. And if we can do that by creating a stronger connection between the providers and the outreach that families are having, we think that will have a great benefit.
Yeah, well, thank you, Mr. Anderson. And I, you know, absolutely what you're saying, I'm just kind of really, you know, I've been doing this a long time and I continuously find out, and what I usually find out is going the wrong way, you know, not the way it should be going. And again, it's just stunning to me that managing care does not mean contacting the patient to make sure they get needed care. Apparently the patient has to contact them and then they pay for it. So I don't know, that to me is not managing care, it's managing money. Finally, before I go to Representative Pryor and members, if you have other questions, if this brings up anything for you, please do ask, but one more I have. I know there's some kind of dental care included as part of that well child. I mean, I know it's cursory, this is not seeing a dentist, but I don't know if you have the information on that. Could you just talk about that a bit? There's some kind of dental aspect to these checkups.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think they do get, it does include fluoride varnish as part of the periodic schedule, you know, on a time basis. Beyond that, as you mentioned, this is not what would be considered a dentist.
Uh-oh, Mr. Anderson, we lost you for a moment.
Child and teen checkup. Oh, I'm sorry.
Now you are, but we lost a little chunk of what you had to say. Sorry, could you just repeat that?
Thank you. Yes, I apologize for the connection issues. As part of the, on a regular scheduled basis, so not necessarily at every well child visit, but on a regular scheduled basis, a fluoride varnish is one of the services that's included in those child and teen checkups. And so, but it's not, as you mentioned, it's not a dental office visit. It's not a hygienist. It's not a full cleaning or those kinds of things.
Okay. And then, okay, let's go to Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I, just so I make sure I'm understanding at a high level kind of what's going on and how, what the impact of this would be, this change going forward. So right now, if counties and tribal services are doing, making this connection and doing the outreach, isn't, are they also doing other things like making sure those families are connected to county services and, you know, part of, you know, I'm kind of wondering about the data and that tracking of information relative to a particular child and how you might interface with, you know, how that interfaces now the system with, you know, special educational services and things like this and how referral, you know, kind of not just medical information, but other kinds of, you know, important information about that child getting referred to, you know, the resources they would need to help to work with the child. So, you know, just now, how does that work into a big picture about how we support families?
Right. So if I'm kind of understanding, or maybe this isn't what you mean, Representative Pryor, but kind of like, is there an additional benefit to families of going through the tribe or county that would be lost if we do it this way? Is that kind of where you're going with it?
Well asked. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative Pryor, I think what I could say, I that would be an excellent question for the counties and tribal nations. It's those conversations or those services are not what we're paying for with these dollars and what we're asking counties to do. I think throughout the integrated healthcare partnership demonstration, we are trying to create incentives for making sure that the IHPs are looking at those social drivers of health in addition to sort of traditional healthcare or medical care. And so part of those conversations as the IHPs are doing the outreach would be hoping that if they are identifying other needs that the child or the family has, that they're in turn connecting that child and family with the social services in their area that would be available to them. Counties and tribal nations may have, as you described, for education services or other needs, may be having reasons to do outreach for the children, but it's not through these payments or through this program.
Representative Pryor, any follow-up?
Right, and thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess I heard the word hoping that, you know, they would be connected to these other resources. But I guess, you know, that would be, I guess in an ideal world, it would be integrated and it, you know, it would be set up front that that we could count on that happening.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative Pryor. Great question. Representative Hewitt.
So I'm sorry, Madam Chair, to the testifier, I guess I'm new to the committee, so I'm learning more about these payer systems. Is this money basically coming, the savings versus the cost, is this money coming out of the county-based purchasing? Is that where it's coming from, or is that something totally different?
Mr. Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative Hewitt, the county-based purchasing program is a different program. So county-based purchasing program only applies, there are only certain counties that have chosen to develop a county-based purchasing program. Again, they would be receiving the managed care capitation payment for managing the services for their enrollees. This payment to counties, this payment at $26.50 for outreach for child and teen checkups is currently paid to all counties, all 87 counties, not just those that decided to participate in county-based purchasing. And it's a payment that is outside of, or if you're a county-based purchasing county, in addition to what those county-based purchasing payments would be. So this is a separate payment, separate activity, and it applies to all counties, not just those doing county-based purchasing. I hope that's responsive.
Yeah, Madam Chair,
Representative Hewitt.
I guess I'm going after back to Representative Pryor's question. So we're not going to see any effects on this to the counties of not being able to perform other services because we're taking over those services for them. Is that correct?
Mr. Anderson.
Correct. Well, so the counties will still have some outreach activities that they will need to do for the enrollees, for the children that are not receiving care from an integrated healthcare partnership. So they will still have that responsibility and still have those payments for the other 50% of the children. But correct that the work that they would need to do outreach, that work would be shifted to the integrated healthcare partnerships. And so that would decrease their workload.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Representative Hewitt. So, Mr. Anderson, before we move off this topic, do we do any sort of follow-up with counties or have any data about how well they've performed this function? I mean, or the tribes for that matter, because, you know, having us only at 51 or 53% of the kids actually getting this service and especially being below the national average on that, I see where members are a little bit concerned about this, but the question I guess is there an alternative way to improve this other than by, and I don't mean to imply that I don't support what you're doing here, because honestly, I think IHPs are just probably a logical place to have this happen in some ways, but has there been any sort of monitoring of what are the counties actually doing to do the outreach? And I have no idea, like, do they call people, do they send them a postcard, what does that outreach even look like?
Madam Chair, with your permission, I'd like to ask Giogo Hayes, my colleague in purchasing and service delivery, to respond to that question, if that's acceptable.
Yeah, absolutely. Mr. Hayes, welcome. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner, committee members. My name is Giogo Hayes with the Department of Human Services. To answer your question, so we have contracts with about 50 different counties and tribes. Some of them are conjoined together to do the outreach. We have an annual agreement with them that articulates exactly what type of outreach they'll be doing. The federal law, to your question, Representative Legally, requires at least one outreach a year to a child. They do that in numerous ways. Sometimes they send postcards, as you mentioned. Sometimes they do letters. Direct phone calls usually follow when they don't get responses to those other features. They do, on occasion, do community events to try to get kids back into the doctor or events in schools, et cetera. We do measure and track their progress. They report back every year on a report that the team reviews. We evaluate for lessons learned and then try to spread those best practices statewide. To your other question about kind of the efficacy, one of the issues is this entire outreach process is driven by claims data submission. And claims data, as you guys have known from previous conversations, can take somewhere between a week to 12 months to show up within our payment system. Once it shows up in our payment system, we then send that information to the counties, and that's where they get some of the information they need in order to further that outreach. And so all that to say, it can take a while depending on what a provider submits a claim. One of our hopes by having this done by the integrated health partnerships is if I'm the doctor and I provide the service, I have the information about whether or not you need a child to check a physical well supplement or not. And so we are hoping that having the same provider involved in the outreach and in delivering the care, as is usually the case with IHPs, that the provider that the person has chosen, we're thinking that we can bridge those things closer together. One last point, this also plays out in referrals. So if you come in for your well child visit, you can follow up on some kind of mental health condition or something. I, as a provider, I know that right there. And if it's got to go through the claims process, it can be several weeks or months before a county notice to call and follow up.
Okay, well, thank you for that explanation, Mr. Hayes. And I think, you know, it does make sense to me to do it that way, but, you know, it is a change. So I'm glad that members have asked some questions. And finally, Justin, I'm going to let you move on to the next thing. But one final question I have about this is, when we calculate that capitation rate that we pay the MCOs, does that rate assume that they are paying for a well child checkup for every child that's covered every year? And then we're only getting 50% of them? Or does it assume that only 50% of them are, or thereabouts, are going to actually get the service? Mr. Anderson?
Madam Chair, so in the capitation rate process, the actuaries look at historical trends of services and utilization. And so they are looking at, as the capitation payment rates are being set, those rates are assuming that based on historical performance, that roughly, you know, in as of 2019, 47% of the children aren't getting into the well child visits that they're supposed to be getting into. And so if we improve those rates and get those up, future years of rate setting of capitation rates will catch up to that improvement.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much for that. So we'll let you go on to the next topic now. Mr. Anderson, go ahead, please.
Next topic is fascinating. This is one that you could sell advertising on your committee webcast here. Compliance with interoperability and patient access regulations. It just sizzles. These are federal rules. So the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, or CMS, has promulgated rules that require certain health information technology to be able to perform certain functions for enrollees. And this includes Medicaid programs. This rule also applies to private commercial health insurance as well. But what it really does is it requires efforts that help deliver health information directly to patients as well as to providers, and moves the health system toward greater interoperability. In other words, that different medical record or payment systems are able to talk to each other and use information across system platforms. And these are, again, these are federal requirements that we're obligated to meet. So one of the most significant changes, just to give you some context or an example of this, is that under the interoperability and patient access rule, patients should have the ability to access and share their own health information via application programming interfaces, or APIs, but basically internet-enabled devices. So from a smartphone or an iPad or tablet, that basically patients should be able to get access to their own health information. This proposal would implement the IT system changes that are required to comply with these new federal regulations for DHS, so that we can make sure that we're meeting those requirements. This includes patients' ability to access their claims and encounter information, as well as a subset of their clinical information, making provider directory information publicly available so that patients can access that information, find out which providers are available for care and treatment. It also will help clinicians be able to help coordinate care better for their patients. It creates payer-to-payer data exchange to help patients move seamlessly between payers over time, so that as they move on and off our programs and onto commercial insurance, for example, that the information would be able to flow accordingly. And then it also updates reporting requirements, the frequency of data exchanges. This is particularly for dual eligibles, those enrollees who are enrolled in Medicaid as well as in Medicare. They're over 65 and low income or disabled and are enrolled in both programs. Medicare is the first payer. Medicaid is the second payer if Medicare doesn't cover a particular service or benefit, and to be able to have reporting and data exchange between Medicare and Medicaid systems. So complying with this rule require coordination with DHS, with our managed care organizations, a lot of work with our partners at MNsure, as well as at the Department of Health. The effective dates within the rule vary by different components and requirements, beginning as early as January 1st, 2021. Some of them went into effect, and enforcement will begin on July 1st, 2021. And so the budget request in the governor's budget is to allow the funding necessary for DHS to create data secure standards based on those requirements that the federal rule is obligating us to be able to provide, so that when the patient does go from their smartphone or a tablet or other internet service, that they're still getting their information securely, that it's still protected under HIPAA and other data privacy rules, that there are standardized web-enabled information about provider networks that are available, and to be able to meet those other requirements. So states are eligible in order to meet these requirements. Federal law, the federal government imposes the rules, says states, your IT systems need to be able to carry out these functions. But with that also comes enhanced federal matching funds for the cost of these services. So the federal government will pay 90% of the costs when we're following the established interface guides and security standards. And so complying with these requirements in order to get us up to where we can comply will require from the state side an investment of $502,000 in fiscal year 22-23 in that biennium, and an investment of $50,000 in the following biennium, 2024-2025. And so I'll pause again for questions.
Right. Okay, thank you. Any questions, members? All right, Representative Damuth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Anderson, can you just tell me how this has any relation, if it does, to HIPAA or the Minnesota Health Records Act?
Mr. Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative Damuth, this does have interaction with both of those laws, the federal HIPAA law and the state Minnesota Data Practices Act and Health Records Act. In that, in order to accomplish these data sharing and data access for enrollees, some of that will be protected health information. And so the standards and the IT systems that we have to be able to protect that information accordingly. So a patient who's going on their smartphone and wants to access their information, we have to have processes and controls to make sure that they don't access other patients' information, for example, or in exchanging information with other health plans or with Medicare, there has to be protections in place to make sure that those are the minimum amount of information necessary as required by HIPAA, or that if it's for something that is not related to payment, treatment, or operations, for example, that it wouldn't be able to be shared unless there's patient consent or patient authorization. So all of those legal requirements remain in place. This rule does not change any of those, and it doesn't give us an exception to any of those rules or anything like that. So we have to design the IT system in a way that's compliant with existing federal and state data privacy rules.
All right. Representative Damuth, any follow-up?
No follow-up. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thanks for asking that question. I'm glad to get that clarified, too. Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. My question is about the IT resources that it takes to do something like this, and it's a huge demand. How are you looking at accommodating that? Is it going to be in addition to people's current roles? Are you going to be bringing in contractors? How are you thinking about it? And it's quite technical and specialized. So I'd just like to hear a little bit about the plan.
Mr. Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. You're absolutely right. It's very technical. It's all IT systems related work. So coding and software development. We are coordinating this with our partners at Minute to be able to figure out how best to be able to accomplish the work and to be able to do that within the sequence and planning for other IT projects as well. There are elements of the proposed rule that it's very likely that we won't be able to meet the timelines that are required because of the sophisticated nature of the work and the amount of time and effort that's going to be taken. With Minute and with DHS, we will, as you parse out the different projects and the different sort of will have to be decisions about how much of that is work that Minute can accomplish, how much do we have to hire outside contractors or vendors to be able to do, which of these IT systems may have proprietary software that we have to contract with that software vendor to be able to accomplish. And so we expect that it will be a combination, you know, ultimately this is a huge undertaking and I fully expect that it will be a combination of both internal work with our partners with Minute, as well as external contracts with vendors.
All right, any follow-up, Representative Breyer?
Thanks, Madam Chair. Just a quick question. So I'm looking at the potential impact if we aren't able to get this system up and fully operational on time, and it looks like there's mainly the financial penalty of $1 million per violation. Is that the main thing? Is there also a patient or provider impact? What are the risks involved in terms of implementing and executing on this?
Mr. Anderson?
Representative, or Madam Chair and Representative, there are multiple potential risks or efforts. These are both in terms of the fiscal impacts or the potential financial penalties. There's more importantly, even in that, is the notion of being able to provide the information and services that our enrollees need and expect. And when you think about the provider directory information, for example, this would make it easier for people to be able to identify which providers are available for the services they need, be able to get access to those services. And so in many respects, while we, and I sort of made fun of the rule at the beginning of my testimony, but this is an effort by the federal government to make sure that our Medicaid program and other commercial insurance is making our services and coverage as accessible and effective for our enrollees as we possibly can. And those are good objectives, things that states fully support. At the same time, states are in a position, Minnesota's not alone, we're not by any stretch of the imagination unusual in this, but we're given timelines and requirements that aren't very feasible. And so looking to CMS to say, listen, we want to do this work. We have to be able to get the work done, and we want to be able to do it correctly. Again, managing privacy expectations, making sure that we're maintaining security. So we want to be able to do it right. And so we've been asking CMS to adjust their deadlines to be able to be more realistic. But also say, you know, this is the kind of work and projects that the demands of responding to COVID-19 took, again, our partners at Minute, their resources and time and effort, DHS, our vendors, everyone had to respond to the emergency and the higher priority needs during COVID. Another reason why we've been asking for CMS to adjust the deadlines in recognition of the stress and pressure that our systems have been under. And we still hope that when July 1st comes around and those first criteria for enforcement come up, that CMS will delay enforcement of those and we'll still be pushing for that with our colleagues in other states.
If
right.
I may, Madam Chair, one last comment.
Representative Breyer.
Thank you. I just want to say that for years, this has been the holy grail of the health plans and the care system achieving interoperability, and countless years and millions of dollars, hundreds of millions have gone into it. And so I'm glad to hear that you're trying, like any good project team, to say, wait, we can't necessarily have this deadline, because it's really important work and it's really valuable. And so I appreciate you taking it on, and I want you to have the latitude to do it well. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Ryer. Representative Pryor.
And if I just, I guess to maybe do like a backup question, which is to put this maybe in the context of, you know, compared to if you only had private insurance, it seems like these things are available to you right now, but that when you're part of public programs, then you don't have access that other people might. Is that the starting point of where we are right now, or is this something that's a problem for everybody?
Mr. Anderson?
Madam Chair, Representative Pryor, this is, as I would describe it, this is a rule that applies across coverage. So it applies to everyone. These are things that some particular plans may offer a more robust technology in one area than another plan might. You know, some are farther ahead in some areas than others. But this is really, when we're talking about interoperability, this is really an industry-wide moonshot that everyone is working toward. We all have a vision of what we all expect and want to be able to have happen, that emergency room physician with an unconscious patient can turn to the computer and pull up that patient's medical records no matter where they are, because who knows what allergy information may be especially important to be able to provide treatment. We all have images of patients being able to access their information, whether they've gone to seven different providers or they've been going to one provider all of their life, and be able to access their information easily. It's simple in its concept, but in actually making it happen and actually getting the systems to do the work, it's incredibly complex and difficult, and has been a long road in trying to pave it. This is a next step in getting that road built. And so it's, like I said, it's something that Medicaid programs across the country have to comply with and are struggling with, but managed care organizations, private commercial insurance plans have to meet these requirements as well, and they are facing similar challenges, and part of it is getting technology to do what it wasn't initially designed to do, but getting it updated and giving it new features and functions. Mm-hmm.
And
Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I know that our data practices laws in Minnesota in many ways are more, there's another layer in Minnesota that we have in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. I want to say that in a way that's neutral. And is it actually going to be more expensive for us to do some of these things, or more complicated because we go beyond HIPAA and have another layer of data practices, privacy regulations around that.
Mr. Anderson?
Madam Chair, Representative, the short answer is yes. So for services, especially things that vendors are building for multiple states, because all the states need to meet these requirements. And there's things where either through Minit or through our vendors, we would otherwise be able to just take a set of software or a programming and be able to just adopt that. We have to modify it. And so vendors have to do special programming to make sure that we're complying with our state laws as well. And each of those, as you know, any customization, any special work has a higher cost associated with it.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Okay. See, never underestimate the interest of this committee in IT. Representative Bonner.
Thank you. Just first of all, thank you for really explaining this in a really thorough way, because I know the challenge is always, how do we make IT interesting and make it accessible for our legislators, right? And in a way that we can understand. Certainly, I get excited about it, and I imagine Liz does too. But for the rest of our colleagues, it may not be as exciting. So thank you for that. And certainly, to your point, this is a little bit the holy grail of what we've been trying to accomplish for a very long time. And, I think the really important part for members to remember is that this is really an attempt to be able to streamline and have really good integrated care across systems, no matter where you live, whether you're in Greater Minnesota or in the urban core, to really have that really comprehensive approach to that. And certainly I applaud that. I'm curious, you mentioned that you are working pretty closely with Minute on laying out, you know, the path for this. And of course, to be realistic, we do want to set good expectations and realize that this is a tremendous undertaking. So there's lots of work to be done to map data, to figure out how it will be stored, make sure that we handle privacy issues, all of those things. And I assume that the legislature will take a active role in those, including the Blue Ribbon Council on IT, of which I am a member, and I know some of our other legislators are. I'm just curious if you have any more additional information on the structure of that work with Minute and how that is playing out, and if there's any specific tools or things that we as legislators can do to help support you in that endeavor.
And, you know, Representative Bonner, I guess before I go to Mr. Anderson, I would just say that I think we're getting into a level of detail here that is maybe is beyond where I'm so glad you're on that commission. And, you know, maybe Mr. Anderson, maybe if you can just respond briefly, and then I, Representative Bonner, if on behalf of all of us, you would follow up with Mr. Anderson, that would be just terrific. Thank you. Mr. Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative Bonner, I'll be very short and actually reverse it. Representative Bonner, I'll follow up with you and bring in our colleagues at Minute who would be able, they're in a much better position to be able to answer that question than I am. And I'd rather not give you incomplete or inaccurate information, but rather get you together with them and our team and make sure that you have the information that's the best response to that we can give you.
I think that's fair. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Thank you. It's wonderful that we have so much talent on this committee that covers so many things. And I don't know, the poor testifier just never knows what you're going to get here. We're putting Mr. Anderson through his paces for sure. Okay, Mr. Anderson, how about we go on to number three?
Great. So number three is expanding the use of our encounter alerting system. The encounter alerting system, or EAS, is a system that DHS began putting in place a few years ago. It basically is as part of our IT infrastructure and to be able to exchange information with providers. What this service does is it allows providers who are participating in the service to be able to get an alert when one of their patients is admitted, discharged, or transferred from a hospital. So it's basically, you know, a way to be able to improve care coordination so that providers know if you've been working with a patient, managing a patient, and they have a emergency room visit and get discharged, to be able to get an alert saying, hey, your patient has had a serious health episode, and be able to help you follow up in more close to real time manner with that. The program started with hospitals and because it's admission, discharge, and transfer information, hospitals needed to be participating in the program in order for it to be very effective. And it has slowly grown to include more providers. What this budget proposal does is try to help create even greater adoption among the provider community, getting to smaller providers to be able to get them to be able to use the system and be able to access the system so that they're also getting those alerts and being able to help coordinate their care. So this is a cost-saving strategy because as we are able to improve care coordination when providers have those alerts closer to real time, they're able to do interventions and be able to improve care and be able to get patients to where they need to be. This is especially important on the admission alert so that a provider that knows that a patient has been admitted to the hospital. If you think of a behavioral health patient, for example, who gets admitted, is put in an inpatient unit, their outpatient care provider who gets that alert then can connect with the hospital and begin the transition plans for where that patient needs to get services after they're stabilized and able to return to the community, and making that transition sooner. It means, especially in behavioral health cases quite often, that the patient is able to be discharged earlier. And so you actually save the costs of those inpatient days. This was CMS and the National Office of National Coordinator recently published companion rules, which impact policies around the new rule. And so that we are, hospitals are required to send event notifications as a condition of provider participation in Medicare and Medicaid. So our encounter alert system will just make it easier for hospitals to be able to meet this requirement. And so it's also helping our provider community and hospital community to be able to do this. So while a majority of the hospitals, as I said, in the state are now sending notifications through the service, we wanna make sure that we're connecting additional community providers. On average, about 25% of the notices that are generated can be matched and delivered to a participant's care coordination panel. In other words, that we're able to, for our enrollees, be able to get the information to the providers that are managing their care and coordinating their care for them. Expanding the service to additional care coordination panels would extend the benefit that's realized already by integrated healthcare partnerships and those providers that have elected to participate in this program so far. This was one of the proposals. I should note that this is one of the strategies that was reviewed by the Blue Ribbon Commission, and comments received were overwhelmingly supportive, noting many of the benefits of this strategy, including better care coordination across systems of care and across the continuum of care, better care coordination with social service agencies and community supports, and the improved timeliness of communication and communication with hospital emergency departments in particular. The proposal, as I said, is a cost-saving proposal. One of the proposals that the agency is especially excited about, because when we can save money by providing better care, those are the sweet spots that we want to be taking advantage of. This reduces general fund expenditures by $3 million in the 2022-23 biennium and by $2.6 million in 2024-25 biennium. It assumes the net general fund savings in 2022-23 is applied against the $100 million that the Blue Ribbon Commission was targeted with achieving. And so that's, I just want to draw that clear connection between the Blue Ribbon Commission's target and this proposal. Again, I'll pause for questions.
All right, are there any questions from members? Okay, if not, Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm sure this was part of your introduction, but now that we've gone from the discussion of how we have to integrate our IT systems, is this ready to go right now that we can have this kind of communication? Is there a layer of coordination and technical work that has to be behind the scenes?
Mr. Anderson?
Madam Chair, Representative, this is a program that is already live and working. We've been using it for a few years, and so this proposal would be expanding it to more providers who could be able to participate in it and their patients who would benefit from it.
Representative Pryor? Okay, and Mr. Anderson, I have a question too. Is there any follow-up to see if the care coordination actually occurs? I mean, it's great to alert the provider that their patient has been admitted, and that is a great opportunity for follow-up and so on, but you know, does it happen? Just telling them your patient's in the hospital doesn't mean that anything happens. Mr. Anderson?
Madam Chair, you're correct. The encounter alert system is really a one-way communication. It is sending alerts to providers that this is what's happening. It is not a a bilateral communication in which then the providers report back what they did with the information. Providers, depending on the type of provider, may have a follow-up or may not have follow-up. And so again, in the case of a behavioral health provider, their patient goes into the emergency department because of suspected COVID, you know, and gets care and released there. There may not be any follow-up in that case because it's not directly related to their behavioral health needs. In other situations, there may be follow-up. And so providers that are getting this information, generally speaking, are getting a significant amount of information from the encounter alert system. And so they are stratifying that and identifying which patients are a highest need to be able to get to reach out to and coordinate and the timing of that. But I can't speak to the percentages of how many are acted upon in terms of active care coordination because of the alert.
So, Mr. Anderson, that being the case, just a little more about how the savings are arrived at. I mean, if the savings are, you know, how do you figure out then that this increasing this actually results in savings that are due to care coordination? It seems like there's a bit of a missing link there.
Madam Chair, I'm going to ask Sarah Orange, my colleague from our healthcare administration, if she can respond to that.
Ms. Orange, welcome.
Madam Chair and members, Sarah Orange from DHS. I believe what we did in the fiscal estimate was a look at the connection between readmissions in instances where we have this connection already in place. So I think particularly in IHPs, and then extrapolated based on kind of a number of providers that we thought might take up this option if it was more widely available. And so that's how we arrived at the savings number. I believe it was 1% reduction, if I'm recalling correctly, of the overall readmission rate.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions on this proposal? Okay. All right. I think very good. So we have. So the next item on the agenda is, and I think Mr. Anderson is off the hook for the time being. So thank you very much, Mr. Anderson. And then we have Kulani Moti here, the Inspector General for the Department of Human Services, to talk about background studies. Welcome, Ms. Moti.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Kulani Moti, and I serve as the Inspector General at DHS in one of the divisions in the Office of Inspector General, our Background Studies Division, which is why I'm here to share more information about today. And so we have several proposals in there, and I'm going to start with the first one, which is our Background Studies transition to a fee schedule. So the fees for the majority of our studies that are fee-based studies are established in statute, and most of these studies are listed with a fee of $20. And that was put into place or enacted around 2005. And anytime a fee was added into the fee structure and it was something different than the base fee, it was whatever that year of enactment, that was what the fee has been at. And so where this has gotten us is that we haven't had any adjustments in our fees since they've been enacted. And as the years have gone on, our fees and costs and third-party payer costs have gone up. So most study types have been introduced, and most of them require a high level of studies, including FBI and national maltreatment checks. And the fees that we're able to collect are actually well below the costs to DHS of completing a study. Our third-party costs a loan to the FBI and BCA, if both checks are required, equal anywhere from $23.25 to $25, based on what the rates were. And if we're only able to charge a $20 fee, we now currently are losing money in all the studies that we can that we conduct. And this doesn't cover all the rest of the expenses that we have for processing our background study. And it has led to a structural deficit within our background studies division, which is estimated to reach about $3.5 million in fiscal year 22. And part of how we got here was when the fees were enacted, they were higher than what our actual costs were, our fixed costs were, so that we were able to pay all that plus be able to administer all of the background studies. And so over the years, whatever reserves that we may have had in order to apply to our infrastructure and our operations have gone to covering these costs as they have outpaced our what we're able to collect. So what we are proposing in this change is to remove the fees from statute and allow DHS to publish a fee schedule. And this would be similar to what the BCA does for their fees that they charge. DHS would implement the updated Chapter 245C, which is our Background Studies Act, effective July 1st, with increases beginning September 1. And then going forward in subsequent years, we would publish on April 1st what the proposed fee increases be with an effective date of July 1. And this would allow DHS to react to changes in third-party and processing costs, give us additional revenue that would allow the division to increase our staffing levels as needed. It would then be able to allow us to ensure timely processing of background studies, better be able to adjust and react to any potential increases that may or may not cause backlogs, and also be able to give us the ability to invest into needed systems upgrades and changes, and to continue to do additional stakeholder engagement. This would also allow us to support the planning to establish what we would like to do is be a fingerprint-based FBI study as the baseline gate study. So what we would want to look at is beginning the planning of creating standards and tiers of our background studies, more aligning where all the studies lie so that we could look at if there any transferabilities between studies so that we wouldn't have to run them as quite as much. And so it's technically cost neutral to the general fund, but this would be an increase in fees to cover our costs of FTEs. And so we'd be looking at with the increases with about 7 FTEs in fiscal year 2022 and with additional FTEs beginning in 2023. Several of these have been planned for, but we had been remained unfunded, and it would increase our capacity to conduct studies and permanently eliminate any of our backlogs and provide critical infrastructure support in the areas of training, IT, and operations and stakeholder and provider support. So with that, I'm going to pause if there are any questions before I go on to the next one.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Moti. And, before we go on with your presentation, I had missed Representative Bonner's hand, and so I'm going to go back to her, and I think her question might have been for Assistant Commissioner Anderson, but Representative Bonner, sorry about that.
No, that's all right. I just wanted to say, I know the question was asked about how we know or understand some of the savings that are realized, and I just wanted to throw in here because I actually have worked for one of the largest healthcare companies in the country, and actually had a special program, and we were looking specifically at hospital readmission prevention. And what we did is a lot of extensive background at looking at the reasons why people end up being readmitted. And often what we found is that the reasons they were being readmitted were really basic things, like they didn't have transportation to go to their follow-up appointments. They, grandma got home and she came home with a very extensive set of instructions and didn't understand when to take her medicine and how much. Or she may have had a medication that upset her tummy, and a simple follow-up from a nurse could help her space out when to use her medication or to take it with food so that she stayed out of the hospital and on her medication and didn't end up back in the hospital. So little things like that, they seem really mundane and strange, but those are often really common reasons why someone might not follow their care plan or get follow-up visits. And might end up being readmitted. So just these are pretty well established methods. So just wanted to kind of throw that out there, and that this is something that we've acknowledged in the industry has been extremely helpful for quite some time.
Right. Thank you, Representative Bonner. Appreciate it. Okay, Ms. Moti, well, let's see if there are any questions for the material that Ms. Moti has just covered. And I don't see any questions on that. So Ms. Moti, you have more to cover, I take it. So please continue.
Okay, thank you.
I should call you Inspector Moti, right? That is probably your title.
Ms. Moti, fine, but thank you.
Yeah.
So the next proposal that I would like to speak about is our federal compliance proposal. And so this is about us remaining in compliance so that we can receive background studies information from the FBI. So in our current chapter in 245C, which is the Human Services Background Studies Act, it has requirements when we would need to query or receive information from the FBI. And this would create a new section within 245C codifying all of the processes for these studies. And so the FBI is requiring us to have certain things put into 245C. And currently right now we have some of the information sitting in 245C and that for background studies requirements and others sitting in the actual program area statutes. And the FBI is requiring that we have all of the background studies requirements in our 245C chapter. So we would need to take a look at moving that over, and we have well over 70 different provider or close to 70 different provider types. So there are many statutes that we would have to work to bring that over on that. And this would also codify a process that would allow DHS to forward study results to state and tribal agencies to make determination of eligibility. And then most importantly would be inclusion of language that changes our basis of authority for DHS to receive the national and state criminal history. Under FBI requirements, we have to cite our authority, or what we call codes, reason codes, to them as to why we can actually query their database on that. And the information that we're receiving from the FBI is that we need to change and we're not correctly submitting the right code. And so we need to be able to convert over to what is called the National Child Protection Act and Vulnerable Children's Act, otherwise known as the NCPA-VCA, and adhere to all of their requirements in order for us to continue to submit to the FBI and receive the national criminal history reports that we would need on this. And it would also add clarifying language for child care facilities that states that employees must be removed from the center if the employee is subsequently found to have committed a disqualifying offense. And so these are requirements that have been identified during audits and mock audits with the FBI and BCA of what we would need to do in order to come into compliance. What this would do is we would be transparent requirements for all study subjects and employers. There would be a clear understanding of differences between standard and alternative background studies, including requirements and processes for study subjects, employers, and policymakers, clear for statutory authority to receive the criminal history data, and bring DHS into compliance with the child care block grant. So for the fiscal information, overall, it would be just over $1 million for fiscal year 22-23 and about $391,000 in fiscal year 24-25. And this would be for the necessary systems changes and provider and study subject support throughout the implementation. It's gonna require extensive system changes to add in the informed consent process that we need to add in for study subjects and streamline our other current manual process in order to process background studies in a timely fashion. We'd be asking for temporary FTEs during the initial implementation, and then two ongoing FTEs to triage and operationalize this new consent process. So with that, I will pause for any questions.
All right, thank you. Members, any questions? It's a lot in there. Representative Damuth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Inspector Moti, maybe this went to the earlier portion, I'm not sure. But with the background studies, what is the average time to complete them? And then how would that average time change with additional staffing?
Inspector Moti.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. I don't have that information at my fingertips right now, and I can get back to you on that one. But what I can share is that depending on when the studies flow in, there are certain studies that stop. For some reason, when they come into our system, something flags in our system that requires additional eyes. Or if, let's say, a study subject lives in another state, that we would need to request information from that state or from a registry in that state. And those are when those delays start to build up, when we have to send out requests and we're maybe not able to timely follow up on those. And so we have some breakdowns of some information, but I can better share that with you. We can get back to you on that, but it would help us be able to timely track that, do our necessary follow-up so that we can process those ones faster on it. But that has historically been where we've had backlogs.
Representative Damon?
Nothing further. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you. Other questions from members? All right. Not seeing any right now. Inspector Moti, do you have more that you want to share with us?
Madam Chair, yes, I have two more just to quickly go over. And the other one is to proposal is to add new study partners into the background studies requirements on this. And I am, one second, I'm so sorry. I was just needing to get to my notes here on this. So in previous years, we had added the Professional Educator Licensing Board to the background studies requirements, and we were working with their acronym is called PELSBY. And we've noted that there's some additional statutory language that we would need to do in order to complete that and to bring that into compliance so we can start doing those studies, as well as adding in MNSHR, those required background studies that we would do for, I believe they're navigators in MNSHR, into 245C. And so this would complete the process for us to be able to run our fingerprints in the NetStudy, our NetStudy 2 system, which is our system that that all of our background studies go through. So this is what proposal we would be adding in. It is cost neutral to the general fund, as there are fees associated with this. And the fee-based is for about 8,000 new background studies at about $51 per study. But we have been working with PELSBY over the last several years, and this is just the final component of adding that in. I think I will pause.
All right. And then, so Inspector Moti, do these agencies then contract with DHS to do these for them? Is that how this works?
Yes, we have, Madam Chair, yes, we have interagency agreements in place that we that allow us to be able to do that. We have several interagency agreements with several agencies, including MDH, DOC, and MnDOT for various studies. So this would be, and so this would be adding it in. And so we also have several others with MDE as well.
Okay, thank you. Are there questions about any of that, members? All right, I'm not seeing any other questions about that piece. Please continue. We have about 11 minutes left in the hearing here, so maybe we can finish up with the pieces you need to share with us today.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the last one that I have is for our adding a new study type, provider study type, to the background studies requirement. And that is for the early intensive developmental and behavioral intervention. So it's the EIDBI autism services, and it's requiring providers to operate within the background studies requirements of our NET Study 2 system. And so this would be adding a study type to that. It would create a fee, which, tying it in with my previous proposal that I talked to, would be something that we would ask to be pulled out of statute. But if those did remain, you want to make sure that that is captured appropriately. So it would be a fee of just over $34 in order to conduct the studies and cover our current costs on this. It would affect about 625 staff per year. And the reason, part of the reason this was added in is that this is a provider type that provides services to autism services to vulnerable adults and children. And so this is something that we feel is necessary to have a background study of requirement for these providers. So we'll pause with that.
All right. And Inspector Moti, there is, I know, a bill for EIDBI licensing, and it's probably something for next year, but just knowing that that's out there, I just want to know, would this, if that was to happen, with this what you've just described be impacted in any way, or is are these same folks gonna have this same background study regardless of whether they have a formal licensing process or not? Inspector Moti?
I will have to double check on that, but I believe if this goes into NEC, they would have the background studies requirements regardless of whether they're licensed or not. But I do want to confirm that, and we can get back to you. I'm sorry, I don't have that information readily available right now.
Okay. And actually, it's not too surprising that you don't, because obviously if we create new licensing, then that licensing probably has some sort of background study of its own. Right, but it kind of depends on what happens and what the legislation is, I assume. So pretty hard to predict the future on that one. But anyway, if you do come up with any thoughts on that, it would be helpful to know in advance. Other questions from members? All right, not seeing any. So we do have a few minutes left. Anything that anybody even wants to circle back on a question on anything that was raised today? So, well, great. Not seeing any. So really appreciate the presentations today, and members, appreciate your good questions and paying attention to all of this, because there is, we're going to be handling a lot of work from now until when we get our budget out. And it's good for members to drill down on some of these things so that we really can vet things as well as we can, and really appreciate all of that. So with that, we will adjourn a few minutes early, and we'll see you tomorrow at 3:00. So with that, we are adjourned.